You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next hour, we'll cover the race for the Elysee. Christine Ocron will be on the line from Paris with the latest campaign analysis and commentary. We'll also hear from author Frank Rose about his new book, The Art of Immersion, about how the digital generation is changing the way we tell stories. Robert Caro has spent the past 36 years writing the life of Lyndon B. Johnson. For a peek into the world of transforming a complex life into the written word, we'll be joined in the studio by former UK government minister and political biographer Andrew Adonis. All that, plus a song or two, here on Midori House on Monocle 24. So, welcome. But before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. The Norwegian anti-Islamic gunman who killed 77 people said at his trial today that his shooting spree and bomb attack were sophisticated and spectacular and that he would do the same thing again. 33-year-old Anders Behring Breivik has pleaded not guilty and said he was defending his country by setting off a car bomb that killed 8 people at government headquarters in Oslo last July, then killing another 69 people in a shooting spree at a youth summer camp organised by the ruling Labour Party. Randi Johansson Pero was in the morning session facing the man who killed her eldest son.
It's not so important what he feels. It's not what it's about. It's about what he has done. And I hope this court will be able to punish him in a way that we can continue as, for me personally, that I can continue my life and that we can have our ordinary life back if we can. That's difficult.
Japan has pledged $60 billion in loans to the International Monetary Fund today in an effort to ensure that the debt crisis in some European economies won't spread even to Japan itself. The Japanese finance minister Yun Azumi announced the emergency loan, which will use the nation's foreign exchange reserves. Well, Sophie Grove spoke earlier to Tyler Brulé, the editor-in-chief of Monocle, who is in Tokyo at the moment, and asked him why Japan was making this unexpected move.
They're still legitimate players within the global economy. And, you know, and then I think there's always the regional issue with the neighbors across the sea. And this also sends out a very strong message to China. China, yes, sure, the world's second biggest economy, but Japan can still play a role and also play a leadership role as well.
The top contenders in France's presidential elections have today clashed over their public spending plans, with the French president Nicolas Sarkozy pouring scorn on his socialist opponent's claims that he would stand in the way of the markets, as financial players worried about the impact of the vote on the country's deficit. In a speech to businessmen in central Paris, Sarkozy criticised the socialist François Hollande's election pledge to hire 64,000 teachers, hinting it smacked of profligacy and would reflect badly on French pledges to keep its deficit under control. The British Prime Minister David Cameron was set to raise issues surrounding the death of British businessman Neil Hayward in China while visiting China's propaganda chief Li Changchun today.
Well, Mr. Li, can I warmly welcome you to number 10 Downing Street. I very much welcome the strong relationship that Britain has with China.
The British businessman whose murder has sparked political upheaval in China was poisoned after he threatened to expose a plan by the wife of Bao Shili, a Chinese leader, to move money abroad. Hayward's death ended Bao's hopes of emerging as a top political figure and threw off balance the Communist Party's looming leadership succession. And finally, the Insect Cookbook comes out today and contains unusual recipes like adding worms to chocolate muffin mix. It's intended to promote insects as a source of protein. To mark the book launch in Wageningen in the Netherlands, the specialist insect chef, Hen van Gurp, will try to set a record for cooking the world's biggest grasshopper pie. Research by scientists at the university there showed that insects could provide the best source of protein to meet the needs of a rising population. Currently, 70% of agricultural land is used for livestock production. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. I like that those really are the stories. Just to prove that the world's largest grasshopper pie really is a news story. There we are. I don't think I'll be tucking into that. You're listening to Midori House. It's 1805 here in London.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e Yorkosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
The latest opinion polls in the battle to be president of France show Nicolas Sarkozy and his socialist challenger François Hollande in a dead heat, although Hollande is still expected to win the runoff. What surprised some analysts, though, is the performance of the secondary candidates, Marine Le Pen, Jean-Luc Mélenchon and François Bayrou. All three could poll at least 10%, which would be the first time that five candidates all got into double figures. For more on this and the rest of the day's events across France, we're joined on the line by Monocle 24's French election commentator, Christine Ocron. Christine, welcome to Monocle 24. So are you surprised that some of the second-tier candidates are doing so well?
Well, Steve, the real sensation of this campaign has been Mélenchon. Now, Mélenchon is as odd to any world audience as the grasshopper pie you were talking about. Mélenchon is a former Trotskyist, a former member of the Socialist Party, and through sheer eloquence and bravado, he's really managed to stir up, you know, the nostalgia for the good old days of Marxist utopia. There should be no poor people, but of course they shouldn't be any rich people either. And everybody's salary should be increased, and the very rich should be taxed 100%. And profit is very wrong, and Europe altogether should be how could I put it, scrapped from history. And he's a very talented, eloquent guy. And, you know, the French are very keen they're very obsessed with words. It's very important in our culture. And so Mélenchon is really a sensation. You were talking about Marine Le Pen. In the beginning of the campaign, she was supposed to achieve a high score. I think that she is indeed fighting for the third position together with Mélenchon. However, the centrist candidate, Bayrou, whom you were also mentioning, who sort of resuscitates at every presidential election, he has done very poorly, even though he's about the only one to talk about the reality of the current economic and financial crisis.
Well, I mean, what does that say then, the fact that Bayrou has been squeezed out and that you've ended up with, certainly Mélenchon on the left and Marine Le Pen on the right seem to still be attracting a decent sort of 15% of voters?
Well, I think as far as Bayrou is concerned, people have realized that he performed quite well 5 years ago, but he has done nothing since. And people have come to realize that whatever he talks about, it hasn't any impact on their lives and on the reality of the crises. And I think the crisis really explains why it's both extremes, you know, the extreme left and the extreme right, which appeal to those people who suffer most from unemployment and who are really anguished about their children's future.
With both Mélenchon and Le Pen scoring so highly, certainly in the teens, it seems to have pulled both Hollande to the left and Sarkozy a bit more to the right. Do you think both of those mainstream candidates will struggle perhaps to tack back towards the centre once the runoff starts next week?
Yes, that's a very good remark. It will be easier for Sarkozy. It's exactly what he did 5 years ago. He was more successful in doing so then than the polls credit him for now. it will be more difficult for Hollande, because Hollande is really being threatened by Mélenchon on his left. And so it's difficult for Hollande, who, you know, to sort of make concessions, at least verbal concessions, to the extreme left, like the famous 75% tax on people who make more than €1 million a year. That was really, the purpose was really to show that Mélenchon was not the only one to be against the rich. But Hollande will find it difficult to go towards the center. It's difficult to, you know, to go to the extreme left and to the center at the same time.
Now, all elections all over the world tend to have broadcast rules, which suggests that every party, every candidate should get equal time. Now, in the US, when there's two main parties, that's not too hard to enforce. Here in the UK, where there's three, again. But in France this week, with the broadcast rules kick in, and if I understand correctly, all 10 candidates have to have equal airtime. Now, how does that actually work in practice?
Oh, it's an absolute headache for state TV and radio. Private networks have a bit more flexibility, but it's a very old-fashioned rule, and it doesn't work really now with social networks and tweets and everything else. So I think that for the next election, these rules somehow have to be changed. But for the time being, indeed, they have to be respected.
And so does that mean that, that Sarkozy and Hollande maybe only get a little sort of 20-second snippet on the main news so that they can get 20 seconds from everyone? Or does it mean that it goes the opposite way, that, Ava Jolly, despite, being at 1% or 2%, gets 2 minutes of airtime every night?
Well, there has to be an absolute equality of airtime on public TV. But of course, we now have these old news channels, and they are also supposed to respect those rules, but there's a little bit more leeway. But it is true that all media, TV and radio, have to give time to very, very marginal candidates who are given an occasion to speak. Sometimes it's quite weird, frankly.
Okay, now just before you go, what do we have to look forward to tomorrow? I mean, what do you think are going to be the big issues that, that Hollande and Sarkozy are going to try to be pushing as we go into the final few days?
You know, what really strikes me is that this campaign is really disconnected from reality. There's a lot of talk, a lot of incantation about the country, France, the Republic, and all that. There are very few precise answers to the real problems. And I think the issue for the main candidates until Sunday will be to try and convince the French to go and vote, because there's a lack of enthusiasm about this campaign, and moreover, we're in the midst of school holidays. So how do you convince the French to go and put a ballot next Sunday when they're not, there's one guy they really don't like, that's Sarkozy, and the other guy whom somehow they don't find quite convincing. So there are polls about the high level of absentees, at least for the first round. And I think that both Sarkozy and Hollande will use these coming few days to convince people to go and vote.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now, Christine. We'll be talking to you again tomorrow on Midori House. But for now, Christine Ocron in Paris, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. We're right back after this.
On this week's Section D, we're talking architecture. We head to Chicago for the third Architecture and Design Film Festival. We hear from the director of a film about embassy architecture, get an overview of the festival, and delve into Chicago's architectural legacy too. We also drop in on Paulista architect Marcio Kogan's studio and sit down with German architectural wunderkind Jürgen Meyerhaar.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald. premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the Global Newsstand, some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. In a moment, we're going to be talking about the wonderful art of biographies. But first, we're going to play a song, and this is The XX and VCR. And that was The XX with VCR. You're listening to Midori House. Now, few biographers approach their task with the dedication of Robert A. Caro. The fourth volume of his epic biography of former US President Lyndon B. Johnson is released at the start of May, 38 years after he began the first. Even then, he still won't be done. The path to power takes us up to the 1964 election. Vietnam, resignation and defeat are all still to come. Caro himself is now 76. Many of the editors involved in the project at Knopf are of similar vintage. It's unlikely that any modern-day publisher or perhaps biographer would consider undertaking such a task now. Joining me in the studio to discuss the art of biographies is Andrew Adonis, now Lord Adonis, who served in government here in the UK under two Labour prime ministers, but is also the official biographer of Roy Jenkins, one of Britain's most influential post-war politicians. Welcome to Midori House, Andrew.
Good evening.
Now, let's start by talking about your work on Roy Jenkins. When did you sort of start as his official biographer?
Well, I was a great friend of Roy Jenkins at the end of his life, though I was a whole generation younger than him. Mm. And it was a very amusing story because I wrote to him. I didn't know him at all well. I'd been a member of his political party, so I was very sympathetic to him. And I think to write a good biography, you
this
need to be...
This is the SDP, the Social Democratic
right.
Party.
Yeah. You need to be sympathetic and empathetic, and they're distinct. They're distinctly different, those two. But he wrote back and said, I don't intend to make a decision about this for some years, he said, because I don't want any biography, any official biography of me to appear while I'm alive. And about 10 years later, when we were having a conversation about something entirely different, because I was by then a reasonably senior journalist, he raised the issue with me and said, are you still interested in doing it? And I said, I would be very much. And then for the last few years of his life, we saw a good deal of each other, but it was on the condition that it wouldn't appear while he was still alive, because his view, as a biographer himself, a very distinguished biographer of Churchill and Gladstone, was that you couldn't write a good biography of somebody who was still alive.
And when you started to think about how you would approach this task, did you give much thought to how long it might take and what sort of job you wanted to do? I'm assuming you didn't think, oh, well, I can, you know, interview a few of the key people and sort of read his papers and knock it out in 3 or 4 years.
My immediate concern was to interview all the people who were associated with him while they were still alive. And in the course of the year after he agreed that I could become his biographer, I did 150 interviews of people who were friends or associates of him, of whom now more than 100 are dead. So my advice to a would-be biographer, if you're writing a biography of anybody who's 70 plus, is get interviewing very quickly, because it's extraordinary how quickly, of course, people move on. And Roy himself has now been dead for 10 years. I can't give an answer to the question about timescale, because in my case, I was in government shortly after I took on the biography. And Roy himself, who was a distinguished politician and one of the most distinguished ministers that England has had since the war, referred to writing history as his minor key. He said politics was his major key. And he only wrote when he was out of government. And it's turned out the same way for me, actually. I was in government all the time under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. And it's only since leaving government that I've had time to write again.
And so when you look at how long it might take to complete, do you have in mind, or do your publishers have in mind, any time when you're going to be expected to hand in a finished manuscript?
Well, these are a long time projects, and I'm still in myself, because I had when I left government, I was writing about my time in government, and I've just finished writing a big book about my experience in government, and also I write seriously about education policy, which is my greater interest in politics. So I haven't got myself into the mode of biographical writing again. However, I have read the 16,000 word essay, which is a brilliant essay by Robert Caro, which is taken from the beginning of the next volume of his biography.
The piece in The New Yorker.
Indeed, yeah. On the day that JFK died, was assassinated. And if the rest of the book is of that quality, then we should be queuing around the block to buy it on the day it comes out, because absolutely scintillating.
Well, indeed. I mean, there's a couple of incredibly good pieces worth reading about Robert Caro, including one in the next month issue of Esquire, which talks about the way that he works. And he still writes everything in pencil. On legal pads, several drafts, and then only then, when he thinks it's finally ready, does he then use the typewriter to do his, well, not quite final draft, but what will become sort of the manuscript. And it's interesting looking at the way he's approached this. He's now been working on Lyndon B. Johnson's life for probably, in fact, a little bit longer than LBJ's actual career. Do you think that you need to approach it with that amount of obsession, that he appears to have done with LBJ?
Well, Roy Jenkins himself said to me that when you're writing somebody's biography, you effectively move in with them. And Roy actually became a friend of mine, but every day I thought about him. I spoke to somebody about him. Every time I saw somebody who was associated with him wearing my biographer's hat, I always had three or four questions I wanted to ask them. So you form an incredibly strong bond with the subject of your biography, and that continues after they die as well. And I'm sure that in Caro's case, it has consumed his life. The difference is, when you're writing the biography of one of the foremost presidents of the United States, you can get away with writing many volumes. There aren't many people who the reading public out there will read, many volumes about.
So there won't be five volumes about Roy Jenkins.
There'll be one volume. And indeed, Roy himself said that Roy, who wrote whose longest biography was of Winston Churchill, that was still one volume. That was his only biography that ran to more than 1,000 pages. And he was apologetic about that. He said that there was no justification for any biography being that long. So I know what view he would have taken about the many volumes of the Robert Caro biography. But having said which, of course, I've read them all, and I think they're absolutely riveting. They're works of art. They recreate the whole political world of the day. And when you're dealing with a figure like LBJ, who is one of the, I suppose, three or four foremost presidents since the war, and presidents of the United States, which is the global power, you can get away with writing in that level of detail. You can get away with 16,000 words on the day that LBJ becomes president, which tells you something about the rest of this volume that we're just about to see. But there aren't very many people, including prominent politicians, who could justify such detailed treatment, or anybody would want to read it in even if it was written.
Well, and also what tends to be the case is that there are several different competing biographies of the same person, of all, somewhere between, 500 and 800 pages, rather than one big volume, big opus of, four or five volumes. So, for example, Tony Blair, there's countless biographies of Blair, but no one has done the complete, the complete works of TB, as it were. Do you think that that sort of task is perhaps now beyond a sort of a modern day publisher, because it's quite an undertaking, isn't it?
In some ways, of course, it's easier to publish multi-volume biographies because you can publish online, you can publish supporting volumes of letters and documents in the way that, for example, the Thatcher Foundation has done with Margaret Thatcher's papers. They've been systematically putting them online. Whereas in the past, it has been possible to do that with very few people. But the key test is whether somebody has massive historical importance. If they do, then the appetite to read about them continues. So Winston Churchill, virtually every letter he wrote has been published in massive companion volumes to Martin Gilbert's biography. And I suspect with LBJ, with Tony Blair, with Bill Clinton, you know, there are a small number of outstandingly important political figures, the appetite to read about them, that won't stop.
Andrew Adonis, thank you very much indeed. And we look forward to one day reading your Roy Jenkins biography.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, yeah, you're so.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I met the Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
And in the next half hour on Midori House, we're going to be heading to Sao Paulo to speak to Jonathan Openshaw. We're going to be heading to Switzerland to speak to Frank Rose. And we're also going to be talking about how one Russian exile in London would install a constitutional monarchy in Russia. And we'll be talking to historian Hal Williams all about that. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Steve. The Norwegian anti-Islamic gunman who killed 77 people said at his trial today that his shooting spree and bomb attack were sophisticated and spectacular, and that he would do the same thing again. 33-year-old Anders Behring Breivik has pleaded not guilty and said he was defending his country by setting off a car bomb that killed 8 people at government headquarters in Oslo last July, then killing another 69 people in a shooting spree at a youth summer camp organised by the ruling Labour Party. Japan has pledged $60 billion in loans to the International Monetary Fund today in an effort to ensure that the debt crisis in some European economies won't spread even to Japan itself. The Japanese Finance Minister Yun Azumi announced the emergency loan, which will use the nation's foreign exchange reserves. The top contenders in France's presidential elections have today clashed over their public spending plans, with the French President Nicolas Sarkozy pouring scorn on his socialist opponent's claims that he would stand in the way of the markets, as financial players worried about the impact of the vote on the country's deficit. And finally, here, the British Prime Minister David Cameron was set to raise issues surrounding the death of British businessman Neil Hayward with visiting Chinese propaganda chief Li Changchung today. The British businessman, whose murder in China has sparked political upheaval in that country, was poisoned after he threatened to expose a plan by the wife of Bo Shi Li, a Chinese leader, to move money abroad. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. Now, there has been a boom in the Brazilian luxury retail market, and it's something we're going to explore in far more detail in the June issue of Monocle magazine. Business editor Jonathan Openshaw is currently in Sao Paulo researching and writing this story, and he joins us on the line now. Jonathan, hello.
Hello, Steve.
So let's start with the basics. This boom in the luxury market, why is it happening, and what does it mean?
I know, it's a tough gig, isn't it, this story?
It is, yes.
Brazilian luxury, so getting out there, experiencing the full range of the market. But no, it is a really interesting story. It's at the moment, we're looking at a kind of $7 billion market, and growth-wise, it's second only to China, so it's right up there. Obviously, last year, it was really highlighted because they had the IHT Luxury Conference there. So that's hosted by Cesar Menkes, had all the kind of big players on the international scene coming over and sampling the changes in the market. Our New York editor Aisham down for that, so we kind of checked in. But, I mean, it is a really interesting one. It's all concentrated in Sao Paulo, where we are at the moment, where we're going to be writing this lead on the kind of changing retail. It's, I think, around 70% of the luxury market is here. And the kind of peg for us is that there's a big, exciting new opening, which is Iguatemi, one of the big mall operators here, is opening a new location set to be kind of the premier location in the in Latin America. So we'll be reporting on that.
And what is it particularly about the Brazilian market that is so attractive at the moment?
Well, obviously, I mean, it's lumped in with the BRICS, so it's up there with Russia, India, China for the growth. I mean, I think the number of millionaires in Sao Paulo, Brazil, is set to triple by 2020. So obviously that's the one to look at. But I mean, it stands out within the BRICS as well because there's the access to credit, really strong and stable economic growth, there's political stability, a solid democratic system, low inflation. So while China and Russia have created these huge kind of luxury booms, some people think bubbles, Brazil's kind of been there growing steadily with a slightly more maybe sophisticated market, a more established market for much longer. And yeah, I mean, I was chatting to Ronnie Rodriguez last night. I went for dinner and interviewed him. He's the founder of Box 1824, which is kind of they're kind of experts on the Brazilian youth consumption market. And he says what's different here is that it's all about having fun in Brazil still. It's not as luxury in China can sometimes feel quite hard work. It's all about money. It's all about the kind of big glitz and glamour. But here, it's all Brazilians have always enjoyed kind of consuming, following trends. They're massive consumers of international media as well, and so there's kind of a bit more joy to the retail scene here as well, and that's something we're definitely seeing.
And also something that, you know, we've picked up on previous trips to Brazil and previous stories we've done there is that actually the service culture is a bit of a step above what you find in other countries.
No, definitely. I mean, people aren't just going into shops to buy. Here, it's really about they go in. It's this hunger for knowledge as well. They're going in to kind of gasp the air of the brand. They want to speak to the assistants about new designs, new trends. They want to understand what's happening on the scene. And it's, I mean, there's really interesting long-standing relationships built up between shop assistants and their customers, who kind of act as insider experts for them. Value customers will get kind of previews of collections. And again, what he was saying is very much, I don't know whether you can take this too seriously, it might have been just an off-the-cuff remark, but he says it's really in the kind of DNA of the national consciousness. And he actually said that when the Portuguese first made contact with American Indians, they traded kind of mirrors and beads for gold, and it was this kind of interest in glamour and in what's new and new technology is something which has still been seen throughout the whole of Brazilian history, and certainly being seen now in the rise of this kind of huge booming middle class and the booming millionaires as well.
And I mean, what are the particular challenges though that the market faces there? Because obviously there's, you know, Brazil is still quite a protectionist economy. You know, so for those companies that are trying to bring in products from outside, I mean, what sort of challenges do they face?
Well, yeah, I mean, Dilma Rousseff recently came out in saying that it's not protectionist, it's defensive, and the subtle difference is she's claiming that this is not
really though.
but it's not that basically there's this. I mean, it is definitely true that there's a huge taxation rate in Brazil. I mean, I think most Brazilians are taxed upwards of, it's something like 34%, and then luxury goods on top of that is another 25%. So obviously this is going to lead to, if you're buying a pair of Louis Vuittons or a kind of Burberry Mac in Sao Paulo, it's going to cost twice, maybe three times what you pay even in the most kind of premier locations in New York or London. So then leads to is you see a lot of kind of Brazilian international shoppers. The Brazilian tourist is apparently the one that all of the big retailers from New York to Milan to London are trying to kind of captivate an interest. But it causes big problems for the domestic market, and it is not something which people have managed to resolve yet. I mean, luxury brands haven't really found their international experience, haven't really been able to find their feet in Brazil, starting to now, but have always had to operate through franchises, through kind of local expertise. And for domestic luxury brands, which Brazil actually does, interestingly, have a few of, again, in contrast to somewhere like China, which hasn't produced them yet, it's hard for them to really find their feet and operate on a world stage. So, yeah, there's big challenges and there's big opportunities, and I think that it's definitely an interesting market to look at and watch at the moment.
Jonathan Openshaw in Sao Paulo, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Steve.
And you can read Jonathan's report on the Brazilian luxury retail market in the June issue of Monocle. You're listening to Midori House.
This week on Monocle 24, we're hijacking the second hour of The Globalist, bubble wrapping it carefully and taking it to the 51st Milan Furniture Fair, Salone del Mobile. We'll be coming to you live each day from 8 to 9 a.m. Central European Time, Tuesday to Friday, from the studios at Il Sole 24 Ore. Join me, Hugo MacDonald, as I bring you the best guests, news, views and reports as events unfold each day. That's at 8 a.m. Central European Time, here on Monocle 24.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
You're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. It is just come up to 18:39 here in London. It is 13:39 in New York City. Now, Frank Rose has written on everything from the history of Apple, as in, obviously, Apple, not, you know, apples that you eat, to the development of artificial intelligence. He's now the author of a new book, The Art of Immersion, detailing the ways that the digital era is revolutionising the concept of storytelling. He's at the Festival of Media in Montreux, Switzerland right now, where he joins us on the line. Welcome, Frank. So in The Art of Immersion, you write about how the internet has changed storytelling. Explain to us, how has the internet changed storytelling?
Right. Well, I think the short answer is by making it nonlinear, by making it very participatory, and by making it increasingly immersive. The truth is that storytelling is very much bound up with technology, and the way we tell stories is a product of the technology of the day, and this day is no different from any other.
And when you talk about this, is this in terms of storytelling in films or in advertising or even just in the stories that we tell each other?
I think in all of those ways, actually. You know, I write about advertising in the book. I also write about film and television and books themselves to a certain extent. And certainly, things like Facebook and Twitter and so forth are very much, you know, affecting the way we communicate with each other. You know, I think one of the big things is that in the industrial age, there was very much a divide between storyteller and audience, and that's no longer the case.
Is that necessarily a good thing, though?
I think it's a good thing, but it's an inevitable thing in any case. You know, when I talk about storytelling being a product of technology, and you look at the mass media that we've been used to until about 10 years ago, that was the only thing we had. And it was a very one-way experience, very linear. The audience was expected to be passive and to consume whatever was delivered. And that's very much not the case anymore.
I mean, there's an argument that there was something to be said for that, that there was at least we knew where things were going, were coming from. That, you know, if I read the New York Times, I know that it's the story's probably been written by a very good reporter. It's been fact-checked several times. If I get a tweet about a piece of news, you know, I'm less sure about its provenance.
Yes, I think that's, there's certainly something to be said for that. I think you have to consider You know, any consider the source with any form of news. I think that the real difference that you find is that things become news that wouldn't have been news before. For example, the Trayvon Martin case in the U.S. Was completely ignored by the media for close to a month. This, of course, was the the black teenager in Florida who was shot to death, completely unarmed, for buying some, after buying some candy while he was walking home. And you have to ask yourself, why did the professional media not see this as a story? And why was it that bloggers did see it as a story and became outraged about it, to the extent that finally the media had to respond?
Yes, although, even in that case, there's an argument that maybe the media didn't respond at first because there are very few black people in senior editorial positions in newspapers and TV news.
Yes, I think that's certainly one possible explanation.
In the book, you talk about this concept of deep media. Explain for us, if you could, sort of what deep media means.
Well, it was sort of an idea that I got from James Cameron. I was interviewing him for a piece on 3D for Wired several years ago, back in 2006, actually. And he was about to start work on Avatar, and he described what he wanted to do as a sort of action-adventure story that takes place on another planet. And he mentioned that to him, the best way to tell a story like this was to create almost a fractal experience, where for the casual fan, you could just watch the movie for, 2.5 hours or so, and that would be enough. But for the more committed fan, you could go deeper. And the pattern would hold. You could go in almost in powers of 10. And that, to me, became sort of a metaphor of one of the key things that's happening, which is that the Internet makes it possible for us to, dive much deeper into any subject, whether it's a movie or a news story or, anything at all. Then it was not that it was possible to do earlier, but certainly more so than it was, in any way easy to do without committing, some fairly serious resources.
But surely even with Avatar, though, the success of Avatar was down to the fact it was, it was an excellent film, rather than the fact that you could go to a website or you could, there were extra things that you could do having seen the film. Surely, no.
Yes, I think I would certainly say so. And in fact, one of Cameron's main avenues for accomplishing this didn't really work, which was he made a deal with Ubisoft to develop a video game based on the movie, and the video game turned out to be not very good. And certainly didn't do a great deal for the movie. The movie itself, especially in the 3D version, was pretty immersive all on its own.
Frank Rose, thank you very much. The book is The Art of Immersion. Coming up, we're going to be talking about monarchies and how you can buy your own monarchy, as it were, with historian Hal Williams. But first, we're going to play you a song. This is Adele versus Daft Punk with Something About the Fire. It's odd that you'd ever say anything about Daft Punk was a little bit lighter or laid back, but that is a little bit more laid back than the Adele original. That was Adele versus Daft Punk with Something About the Fire. You're listening to Midori House. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. London exile Boris Berezovsky announced on Sunday that under his new Resurrection Movement political party, he would install a constitutional monarchy in Russia and name Britain's Prince Harry as a candidate for king. Now, odd as it might seem, this wouldn't be the first time that nations have been shopping around for other royals. For his take on this case and similar royal oddities, we're joined now in the studio by historian Hal Williams. Hal, welcome to Midori House.
Great pleasure to be here.
Now, this wouldn't be the first time, would it, that a country had gone elsewhere to find the right king or queen?
No, indeed. Monarchy in its classic form, royal houses, especially in the days when they had real power, has always had to go international. It's had to be an international business because being a member of a royal family, being a sovereign, is a pretty specialist kind of job, but not everybody can do it. Not even the grandest duke or the most influential count or earl necessarily cuts the mustard as a monarch. So the pool of talent is quite limited within a particular country. And even the pool of talent internationally is quite small, because how many people would really want to put up with the sheer boredom of being a queen or a king all day long?
So give us some examples then of occasions where countries have gone elsewhere to find their head of state.
Well, just to think of the Russians themselves, who may about to have Prince Harry visited upon them to uproarious effect, I've no doubt. We all think of the Empress Catherine the Great as the quintessential autocratic, despotic Russian ruler, but she started her life as a German princess. She is a Princess von Anhalt, and she was born in Pomerania, where her father, a rather impoverished prince, but possessive of a genuine title, was in charge of the local town. He was the military governor in Stettin. And because they had no money, she had to make a really good match, and she made one of the most remarkable royal matches in the history of monarchy, and she was shipped off. And as those who remember that wonderful movie by Joseph von Sternberg, Scarlet Empress, played very appropriately by another German, Marlene von Dietrich, as it were, she made an unforgettable impact on the nature of the imperial and Russian story. Our own monarchy, of course,
Has a certain German twinge.
Has a very pronounced German twinge ever since the beginning of the 18th century, when we had to import the Hanoverians because they were just about the only available decent-minded Protestants around, and dozens of Catholic Protestants, dozens of Catholic European monarchs who might have been suitable, were got rid of along the way because we had to clear the way for the arrival of these German princes. Subsequently, of course, much strengthened by German dynastic alliances that the Hanoverians made along the way, such as, for example, George V, who married Queen Mary, who was herself a German princess. So the German origins is very, very strong in our own royal family.
And we've seen this as well in countries like Greece and Albania. I mean, what is it that, you know, let's take Albania as an example. I mean, what is it that, you know, Albania would be looking for then in a monarch which would make them look outside of their own borders?
Well, classically speaking, an awful lot of these invented Johnny-come-lately royal thrones became available after the Congress of Vienna in 1815, when the reactionary powers all over Europe decided we need to go back to monarchy, we need to get rid of these all-too-exciting liberal ideas associated with the French Revolution. So we need strong dynasties and monarchs on the move prepared to endorse reactionary policies. I mean, that was how the Danish royal family, for example, exported many of its members who subsequently became kings of the newly established Greek monarchy in the 1810s and then in the 1820s. So they're looking for people who will endorse the established order. That's a pretty basic political fact of life about them. But then socially, they're looking for people who are prepared to be bored for quite a long part of the day because you have to go around and be nice and very sociable with people whom you don't necessarily like very much, and cut a lot of ribbons and make a lot of speeches written for you by other people.
And is this just sort of, you know, an 18th, 19th century tradition, or have there been more recent examples, maybe in the later 20th century, where countries have decided that maybe they don't need an elected head of state, or maybe the royal princes and princesses they got might not be quite up to scratch?
Well, the Albanians got into trouble in the early part of the 20th century, the 20s and 30s, because their ruling dynasties just ran out of steam. And they went abroad to look for a renewed member of their royal family. They even canvassed the possibility of a very famous English cricketer called C.B. Fry. A big figure in English cricket.
Who could have been Albanian king?
He could have been the king of Albania. He was actually offered the throne, in which case he would have been the only man in Wisden to be actually, while he was in Wisden and recorded as a cricketer, a real king on a real throne. Nonetheless, he turned it down. He had other things to do.
That's a shame. That would have been quite impressive to
it
be
would have been.
In Wisden and also the king of Albania.
That would have been quite a first.
Okay, but since the 20s and 30s, this seems to have died out as a tradition, has it not?
The Scandinavians do a little bit of import and export business on this basis. Norwegians, Danes,
Swedes tends to be more about marrying out your princes and princesses to other royal families, doesn't it? Rather than actually, going in straight at the top as the head honcho.
Yeah, that has now died out, I think, as a practice, and is, despite Berezovsky's very engaging claim, and he must feel very happy at the moment, I guess, because he's advancing this just ahead of the judgment in the High Court of Justice on the libel case that's been deliberated. So this may be a very wonderful bit of Berezovsky PR play ahead of that judgment.
Yes, and Prince Harry is unlikely to be tempted, I guess, even if it were to be a realistic option of becoming a king of Russia. Although it is quite a good job title. I guess you get to call yourself a Tsar.
I think that your next issue here in Midori House will have to concentrate on the availability of babe magnets in central Moscow, and then you'll have to see whether he might actually bite.
OK. Hal Williams, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagat ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosau.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And that is just about all we have time for on this Thursday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. At 22 hours London time, that's in 3 hours' time, Tom Burgess Watson and Louise Beale will be back with the Monocle Daily. They're going to be talking about the conviction that's happened today of James Ibori, the former Nigerian governor. Tyler's going to be on the line from Japan. And also they're going to be speaking to Liam Aldous on the latest Spanish royal PR disaster. Once more, it involves a gun. Up next after the news, you can enjoy the latest episode of Section D with Hugo MacDonald. And talking of Hugo, remember that we're broadcasting live from Milan for the second hour of The Globalist every day this week. Hugo will be on tomorrow, 7 a.m. London time, 8 a.m. Milan time, bring you all the highlights from the Salone Furniture Fair and talking to world leaders in design. News is next, then culture. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.